The tape that you are about to hear has been declassified by disability and disadvantage analysts at CFMU Radio. This taped record of conversation had never been heard before being released to you, the CFMU listener. This tape has been condensed and edited from live, personal, or telephone conversation. You will hear privileged discussions, damning indictments, and stark revelations. Once known collectively only to the agents intercepting them, these files have been tagged with the distinct identifier, disrespect. Disrespect welcomes Dr. John Esdale, Scientific Director of Arthritis Research Canada, is that correct? And you're also the Arthur Child Chair in Arthritis Research at the University of Calgary.
Thank you.
I was most intrigued by your quote that diagnosing arthritis late is akin to malpractice, and that given the new medication that's available, of which you're obviously aware, it can be completely reversed.
Yes, this is really derived from 25 years of the research advance, where it's become apparent that for inflammatory arthritis,
yes,
so conditions such as rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis,
okay,
that treatment radically alters the prognosis. For instance, for rheumatoid arthritis, it used to be that on average, someone on being diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis would have had 12 years taken off their life.
Oh, my gosh.
Not to mention the fact that they would, on average, become very severely disabled.
Okay.
Now, we know that early diagnosis, so when we talk early, we're hoping that the person sees an arthritis specialist within 6 weeks and certainly not later than 3 months.
Right.
That intervention rapidly with the panoply of drugs we have now,
okay,
will eliminate that increased risk of death,
okay,
which is pretty dramatic. If someone says, look, if we diagnose you early, we're going to give you back 12 years of your life,
yeah,
I think most of us would say, oh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, good deal. I'll take it, yeah.
Yeah. So, yes, it's been a big change, and the reality is it's not that surprising. There are very few diseases where you don't want to treat it early. One would never sit around saying, oh, let's just look at this cancer for a while. So with the development of drugs that alter the outcome,
right,
early diagnosis becomes very important.
Right. How does someone who is going to an appointment to diagnose what seems to be inflammatory pain, how do they tell osteoarthritis from rheumatoid arthritis or some other kind of arthritis that flares up and goes away?
I think that's a great question. And we've actually developed an app, an arthritis app for the public, and admittedly right now it's only available if you have an Apple, iPhone, iTouch, iPad.
All right.
But if you go to the Apple Store, and it's free, and download an app called Arthritis,
mm-hmm,
ID,
okay,
then there's actually a consumer questionnaire on it that will say, perhaps this is osteoarthritis, or you should speak to your doctor about psoriatic arthritis or inflammatory arthritis, this sort of thing. And it has a lot on drugs and symptoms and so on. Has for inflammatory types of arthritis, it has something called the red flags. So
oh, okay,
some of these red flags, I think, are that if you're waking up in the morning and are very stiff, it's taking you, 45 minutes, an hour to get your joints going before they ease up.
Right.
That's inflammation.
All right.
If you're waking up at night a lot with joint pain, that's usually inflammation. Right. If the joints are swollen, that's usually inflammation. So any of those things, I think, you really need to be following up, and then there are tests and things that can help. And certainly, if it's not going away, it's reasonable to even see an arthritis specialist.
Okay. So if you have arthritis that's not in a joint, does that limit its type or its likely prognosis?
Arthritis is by definition in a joint.
Okay.
So it's like a knee, elbow, wrist, finger, whatever. Now, you're right, though. You're quite right. There are conditions seen by arthritis specialists that are not in joints, and the person presents with pain. So they're pain in the muscles and this sort of thing. And some of these are very important conditions. Fortunately, generally not that common, although a common one is called polymyalgia rheumatica.
Okay.
And that one affects us generally when we're over 60, and you get these terrible aches and pains all over, again with this significant stiffness in the morning.
Okay.
So these are red flags that should alert someone and should alert their doctor to the fact that there's something significant going on.
All right, not to dwell on my own limited experience, but I'm aware of someone who believes they were diagnosed with arthritis in the chest wall, and that sounds like that's not possible.
No, it is. There are joints in the chest wall.
Oh.
Your ribs, of course, have to attach to something.
Right.
And there's the breastbone, that sort of bone in the middle, where the ribs attach, and they're called costochondral joints.
Right.
So.
All right.
Big, long name, but basically it's where the rib joins the breastbone.
Okay.
And they can get inflamed certainly can be symptomatic and can be very symptomatic.
Okay. So this could be rheumatoid arthritis as well.
It's not a very common site for involvement of rheumatoid arthritis, but there are other types of inflammation where you get involvement of the breastbone joints.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it could be if they're it's possible. One can have just isolated involvement of those breastbone rib junctions that are not part of a bigger inflammatory arthritis, too.
Yeah, okay. So the basic lesson at the start of this is go right away to your doctor and get a referral to an arthritis specialist if you have inflammation of some kind that you don't understand that is recurring.
Yes, I think the inflammatory... The person with those inflammatory symptoms, unless the doctor is very familiar with it, it's probably best they get sent to an arthritis specialist, at least for diagnosis and coming up with a game plan.
Right.
Then the family doctor, of course, can be very involved in the game plan itself.
Now, I get the feeling from this article that I've read that, and I don't have arthritis or have much familiarity with it, but I get the feeling from it that it was not reversible until recently.
Right. I think there's been this huge shift. First of all, I won't say how long it is since I started studying rheumatology, but it's quite a while ago. And when I was a medical student, they'd say, oh, well, don't treat a case of rheumatoid arthritis for a year, because we really don't have any treatments. Now, what happened really starting in the 70s, mid-70s, and then especially in the 80s, when drugs were developed or old drugs were suddenly found to be very good for treating rheumatoid arthritis.
Oh.
And by the 90s, we had, suddenly a little repertoire of drugs that could be used.
Mm.
And we found that if you use them early,
right,
if you use them in combination so aggressively,
right,
you could alter people's condition quite dramatically.
Oh.
And then starting in about 2000, there were very new drugs called biologic agents that are very powerful and very expensive that were developed, so that even if these conventional drugs fail. There are now this new group of agents that can seemingly, in people in whom they work, arrest the disease.
Oh, okay. Wow. So this has been possible for how long? 10 years?
Yeah, at least 10 years, more than 10 years. And certainly, you know, it's over the last 25 that we've become convinced that really you need to move early.
I see.
Initially, we'd say move early and use the typical drug-like things. And then since 2000, we've had this new repertoire of biologic agents for very severe cases.
Right. This application that you spoke of, Arthritis ID, is it available on the web or is it available through another medium?
Yes. If you just go on to the internet to the iTunes Apple Store,
yeah.
Or if you have an iPhone, you just iTouch or something, you just go to the App Store will take you automatically to the Apple one, and put in Arthritis ID. It should come up. It's in the top 20. It was developed, came out last fall, was invented by us and a group called Arthritis Consumer Experts, who were the leaders in it, and it's in the top 20 medical apps.
Oh, good. Okay. You've also made a statement that up to half of patients with arthritis in Canada are not seeing a specialist, that in fact they're misdiagnosed by family doctors. How did we come to the state where family doctors are reluctant to refer? I'm not aware of that.
Well, I think it is part. There's a number of factors. One, in most medical schools, over 4 years, you'll have maybe 20 hours maximum, and some much less, devoted to arthritis.
All right.
Most medical students will spend a lot more time listening for heart murmurs
right.
than they'll ever have on the 100 types of arthritis.
Wow.
So if you've got 100 types of arthritis and you're getting, let's say you're at a really big school and you get 20 hours, you're talking about 5 minutes on each.
And does this reflect a devaluation of the importance of arthritis in medical care? Because it's chronic?
It's chronic, yes. It was seen as chronic, and there was nothing that could be done.
Okay.
Now, this is clearly no longer true.
Right.
And unfortunately, the medical curricula have not really kept up with that at all.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first problem. The doctor is trained and has very little exposure to arthritis, unless they went and, you know, on one of their electives, went and worked with an arthritis doctor. And then they may go into a family practice program where, again, there's very, very little time spent on arthritis. And then they go into their office where 1 in 10 patients will have a musculoskeletal complaint.
All right.
Now, some of them are just, you know, I banged my elbow. I woke up this morning, my neck was stiff.
Yeah.
But some, of course, can be more serious.
Yeah.
And for rheumatoid arthritis, it's about 1 in 100, and other types of inflammatory arthritis, it's another 1 in 100. So something like 1 or 2 per 100 of a family doctor's practice will have, I'd say 2 per 100 will have a serious arthritis.
Okay. Well, that's still not an insignificant number. No. All right. So, yeah, you've said, or at least the article that in which you were quoted has said that the early and aggressive treatment of arthritis is the medical breakthrough that few people, including many family doctors, have ever heard of. And you say the only way they will have heard of it is if they've taken this as an elective for training, right?
Right, or that they, you know, they go to some, there are what's called continuing medical education. So they, you know, they go to courses and hopefully they all do that, or a reading. They're required to continue to get training. We all are. And one would hope that they would spend some time at an arthritis course and they would inevitably hear about this, because certainly it's such a big change. But not everyone has,
mm-hmm.
that's for sure. And in fact, the way we're so certain of it is that a young scientist at the Arthritis Research Center, Diane Lacai in Vancouver,
right.
was able to get data on 34,000 people with rheumatoid arthritis with the help of the government in the province, and showed that half of them were not getting the drugs that they needed, and almost without fail, the people who were not getting the drugs they were needed were seeing only a family doctor. So this identified the problem. She was able to go and get additional information to prove that they had rheumatoid arthritis, that it wasn't sort of a coding error or anything.
Yeah.
And then research in Quebec and Ontario found nearly identical results. So it does appear that there are individuals with rheumatoid arthritis who are not being treated with the drugs that would alter the long-term outcome.
And what are biologics?
Biologics are new. So most drugs, you know, are like an aspirin. It's a simple chemical.
Mm-hmm.
You could, you know, you can sort of make it in the lab. It's not a complicated thing.
Okay.
But biologic agents are proteins. So they are very large molecules with all sorts of these amino acids stuck together. Often they are an antibody. And so the antibody will target generally a single molecule in the body, where aspirin goes and has, you know, affects hundreds and hundreds of different things in the body. These targeted molecules pick off a single molecule, and generally the targets have been some key element in the inflammation cascade. So the process that leads to the inflammation that results in joint damage, joint destruction, and so on.
Right.
And you give the biologics. In the past, it's always been you had to give it by a shot,
oh, yeah.
Although I think soon we'll be able to give them by a pill or more chemical-like molecules that work like a biologic as a pill. And they are very powerful. They can go in and shut down or nearly shut down some aspect that is damaging. And the trick is, of course, shutting down the bad, you know, shutting down enough so that everything else is left working normally.
Right. Things are looking up for our arthritis sufferer. It's time to take a break and celebrate. Etta James. Something's got a hold on me.
Oh, sometimes I get a good feeling, yeah. Yeah. I get a feeling that I never, 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 never had before. No, no. Yeah. I just want to tell you right now that, I believe, I really do believe that something's got a hold on me, yeah.
Oh, it must be love.
Oh, something's got a hold on me right now, child.
Oh, it must be love.
Let me tell you now, I've got a feeling, I feel so strange. Everything about me seems to have changed. Step by step, I got a brand new walk. I even sound sweeter.
You've been listening to Dr. John Esdaile of University of British Columbia, who, working with Dr. Hart at the University of Calgary, has developed Biologics, a new drug regimen for arthritis sufferers that can halt the effects of the degenerative disease. Now, you work at the University of Calgary as well. I gather you work there with Dr. Hart?
I do.
Okay. And he's talking about the next generation of biologics and predictive tools. Are we talking about genetic predictions?
It certainly could be genetic prediction. It could be, in other words, how your genes would tell the body to metabolize things. It may be that a drug, one of these biologics or a drug, we know for one drug, a very good example, that one's genes determine how you get side effects from it.
All right.
And thus, one's genes may determine whether you respond well, whether you don't respond to a given drug.
Okay.
And or biologic. And this is obviously a very exciting potential, although it really has not been demonstrated to date.
Have any provinces approved the funding of these drugs?
All of the provinces fund them.
Oh, good. It's
yes,
just different,
no, this
under
is,
different
they,
conditions.
Yeah, right. There are different conditions, different drugs. So each province is not identical.
Mm-hmm.
There are often criteria for using a drug.
Right.
And it may be something like you need to use so many of the conventional drugs and have failed. So the much less expensive drugs before you could use one of the very expensive biologics.
But you say that rheumatoid arthritis is degenerative and can cause permanent damage in 6 months. So
right.
how long does this process tend to take, and how can you, and if you have rheumatoid arthritis, for example, and you want to be sure that you get the best treatment, how long should you stick with the treatment before you determine that it's not working?
Right. I think the quote was from Ed Keystone at the Mount Sinai, and I think, I don't recall the quote exactly, but it's certainly what I think he meant to say, is that he wants people on some drug within 6 months.
Okay.
That we know, and we were one of the first to do a study showing that 6 to 9 months of no therapy whatsoever is enough to lead to changes that are not easily reversed, even that short a period. So I think what Ed Keystone is saying, he wants early diagnosis. He wants people on drugs that we know can influence the outcome by that time.
So, then I'm being alarmist because I'm not recognizing that even a less than optimal treatment is a big difference than no treatment, is what I'm hearing.
Right. I don't think the conventional drugs are less than optimal.
Okay.
There are people who respond very well to them and don't need the biologic drugs.
I would say
the majority of people with rheumatoid arthritis today are not needing biologic drugs.
Okay. All right. I'm glad to make that distinction then.
I think it's important that not everyone needs them. They are powerful, and they do have some additional side effects. So that doctors generally are not going to use them unless the disease is not well controlled on the conventional drugs.
All right.
And if it isn't well controlled on the conventional drugs, then they become an excellent option.
Very good. Are there other symptoms besides the inflammation? Direct inflammation that people should be aware of is, and I know this is an autoimmune disease, would people experience fatigue when their body's dealing with this kind of autoimmune conflict?
I think we may have to give you your medical degree. Yes, inflammation causes fatigue.
Oh, okay.
And
simple.
That when you think about something even like the flu, mm-hmm. You get the flu and you feel very tired, that's because of molecules, inflammatory molecules that the body is releasing to fight the virus. Now, you fight the virus and you bounce back and very quickly you're normal. With serious inflammation from, say, rheumatoid arthritis or other conditions like lupus, you can have a lot of fatigue that is due to the inflammation.
So if you have a lot of fatigue, and you feel you have arthritis, even if you've been diagnosed with some kind of arthritis that is not rheumatoid arthritis, the fatigue might lead you to go back and seek further inquiry, right?
Absolutely. So joint pain can be with inflammatory or non-inflammatory, although having lots of joints involved makes it more likely that it's inflammatory. And then fatigue, a lot of stiffness in the morning, and swelling of joints would be things that certainly would justify, you know, quite a thorough evaluation.
Yeah. So swelling in the joints would normally occur where you have a lot of joints. It would occur in the feet or the hands, for instance.
Right.
Oh, okay.
That when the arthritis specialist tends to be able to detect very subtle amounts of swelling. So in the knuckles of the hand, the wrists, and so on.
Right.
And frankly, having a persistently swollen joint is not normal.
Right.
If there's fluid, soft tissue, swelling, this is not a normal thing.
Okay. All right. Well, you've given us a very good guide to, you know, how to become aware of this, what can be done, who is helped and how. What is it you'd like to say about this situation with the new drugs and the emphasis on early treatment of some kind and the new option for biologics? What would you like to say to people who are wondering if they're suffering from arthritis and maybe have tried some treatments, maybe not?
Well, I certainly encourage people to, you know, see their family doctor, and if there's evidence that this could be an inflammatory arthritis, or in fact it's just an arthritis that the family doctor is finding difficult to help with, that they be sent on to an arthritis specialist. That truly, there's so much more we can do than a decade ago, and even more than 20 years ago. I tell people, you know, there's no reason that we should not be able to get you back to functioning normally if you're seen early. So I really think we can feel optimistic, and people with concerns need to get them followed up.
Now, I take it from what you say that even if it's not seen early, it can be arrested at whatever state.
Absolutely.
It's at. Very good.
I mean, it's not that we don't, we can't make a big difference if they're seen later. It's just that with time, damage occurs, and what we can't reverse is damage. We can reverse inflammation before
right.
it causes damage.
Right.
So that hitting it early means you stop the inflammation and you prevent the damage.
That's a good sum up. I appreciate your time with me today.
Thank you very much. Glad I could help.
I'm sure you have. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Dr. John Esdaile of University of British Columbia, who, working with Dr. Hart at the University of Calgary, has developed Biologics, a new drug regimen for arthritis sufferers that can halt the effects of the degenerative disease. You know it's time for Disrespect's Review of the News. These aren't the articles we read to you. These are excerpts from the article condensed for radio. The original reporters for the articles and the newspapers will read to you during the broadcast. Court quashes 60 scoop suit by natives. Ottawa wins appeal of class action on behalf of 16,000 kids taken from homes. The federal government has won its appeal in divisional court against a class action lawsuit on behalf of 16,000 Aboriginal children taken from reserves in Ontario in what's known as the 60s scoop. The decision is seen as a major setback for Aboriginal plaintiffs, now adults, who allege Ottawa stripped them of their cultural identity by sending them off as children to non-Aboriginal homes. Many told stories of abuse, alienation, and isolation in foster and adoptive homes in Canada and the U.S. Canada's strategy is to get us out of the way, lead plaintiff Marcia Brown, 48, said Wednesday from Beaverhouse First Nation in northeastern Ontario. What I truly feel is that it isn't a fair system for First Nations people. Brown, an Ojibwa who was taken when she was 4, says her non-Aboriginal mother tried to wash away her dirty brown color and burned a stuffed tiger full of Indian bugs. However, their Toronto lawyer, Morris Cooper, who represents the plaintiffs, along with fellow lawyer Jeffrey Wilson, vows the battle isn't over. Ottawa has deep pockets, says Cooper, and its strategy is to drag out legal proceedings at a great cost to taxpayers. Although the children were removed by provincial authorities, the class action suit was brought against the Attorney General of Canada because the federal government is responsible for Aboriginal people. The setback means that Cooper and Wilson must now win two battles in order to get back to the court with their class action suit. They must first win the right to appeal a ruling by the divisional court, and then, if victorious, win the appeal itself. If they don't, Cooper says the setback could set them back 3 years, almost back to the beginning. It's ironic, he says, given that copycat class action suits on behalf of 60 Scoop children are in the works in BC, Alberta, and New Brunswick. That story by Linda Diebel in the Toronto Star. Hearst probe. Jurors hear 9/11 calls. The 9/11 calls placed for James Hearst, who died while waiting more than half an hour for an ambulance, were played at a coroner's inquest. It took a third call and the person on the line saying that Mr. Hearst had no pulse for Toronto EMS to upgrade the call's urgency. The audio from all three 9/11 calls and the conversations between paramedics and dispatchers were played for a five-person jury and coroner Albert Lowers during the second day of the inquest, which is expected to last several weeks. The jury may make recommendations on how to avoid similar deaths. The second lowest priority was given to the initial call made by a passerby in the lobby who said Mr. Hearst looked like he had passed out and fallen on his face. "He looks like he might be drunk," the man said. About 10 minutes later, an ambulance arrived nearby, but idled out of sight, waiting for police, because the paramedics were concerned for their safety, coroner's counsel Stefania Verasian told the jury. The second 9/11 call came about 15 minutes later from an employee of the apartment security company who said Mr. Hearst had a bleeding nose and was turning blue in the face. "Reassure him help is on the way," the call taker said. By the third call, the security guard was audibly distraught. She was repeatedly given CPR instructions. "I don't think you guys are listening to me. That's what we've been doing for the last 10 minutes, she said. Mr. Hearst's death came days into the 2009 citywide strike when paramedic staffing was at 75%. The city maintains the strike wasn't connected to the delay, but jurors will tackle how the essential services agreement was administered. That story in the Globe and Mail by Karis Mills. Teen looks scared, inquest told. Junior Manon died after officers put their weight on his chest. DTC driver Lisa Edgar told the inquest she opened the door of her bus on Founders Road, just south of Steeles Avenue West, in hopes the fleeing man would run on board, where he could be arrested. Said Edgar, the man didn't look aggressive, more scared than anything else. He just looked like he was trying to get out of the situation. Edgar said Manon was shirtless and she couldn't see a weapon. Moments earlier, the teenager had been pulled over by Constable Michael Adams and Sergeant Stuart Blower for an expired temporary validation permit while driving on Steeles Avenue West, just north of York University, around 6:30 p.m. on May 5, 2010. The teen ran when Adams tried to arrest him for breach of probation, twisting out of his shirt, which the officer had a hold of. Manon was eventually caught. The provincial coroner ruled the teenager was asphyxiated because he was restrained face down with the weight of the officers on his chest. An SIU investigation cleared Adams and Blower last January. Todd Zubik watched the arrest unfold from his bike. "You could tell he was winded and he looked a bit scared as well," said Zubik, a security official at York University and a former OPP officer. He watched as Adams grabbed at Manon's pants and the two toppled over into the grass. "Adams was using his chest weight to restrain Manon," said Zubik. Manon was face down. At one point, another officer hit Manon three times in the ribs. Zubik said he overheard the teen say, "Stop, I'm not resisting." Zubik said he left when it seemed everything was under control. Moments later, he heard an officer say, "Stop resisting," and he circled back to look. Manon was on the ground, not moving. That story by Patty Winsa, staff reporter at the Toronto Star. Cop accuser threw up blood, officer testifies. A drug dealer was bleeding from his forehead and throwing up blood before he alleged drug squad detectives beat him, according to a police officer. Christopher Quigley was in a police station cell shortly after 4 a.m. on May 1, 1998, complaining of sore ribs and difficulty breathing, according to notes taken at the time by Constable Mark Lefevre. Quigley asked to be taken to hospital, and he was transported by ambulance with Lefevre accompanying him. At Sunnybrook Hospital, a police officer noted Quigley told a nurse, "They beat the shit out of me. That's what happened." As the nurse examined Quigley, Lefevre noticed welts on his lower left side and rib area. The prisoner was given 7 stitches to his forehead. Lefevre was testifying at the Ontario Superior Court trial of John Scherzer, 54, Steve Correa, 44, Raymond Pillard, 47, Ned Mayotis, 48, and Joseph Miched, 53. The former Central Field Command drug squad officers collectively face 29 charges laid in January 2004, including attempt to obstruct justice, perjury, assault, and extortion related to their work between 1997 and 2002. Quigley testified that drug squad officers brutally kicked, punched, and choked him unconscious while angrily demanding the whereabouts of his drugs and money, and then they stole $31,000. In other evidence, Quigley's former lawyer testified he was shocked by how his client looked at his bail hearing shortly after the incident. Quigley was charged with assaulting a police officer, possessing stolen goods, trafficking, and possessing marijuana. Under intense pressure from Quigley to get the matter resolved, his lawyer Bruce Olmstead said he worked out a plea deal where his client could plead guilty to just a pot possession charge and pay a $1,000 fine. That story by Peter Small of the Courts Bureau at the Toronto Star. And in an editorial, why has an Alberta judge ruled that Gordon Bowe, tasered and restrained by several officers, died from excited delirium syndrome? Why is Judge Heather Lamoureux of Alberta Provincial Court proposing everything from the training of police dispatchers in diagnosing excited delirium to the creation of a countrywide excited delirium database? Excited delirium, overheating, and wild behavior is a blind alley, not a recognized medical condition. It's a convenient way to avoid tough scrutiny of police practices that may contribute to death. Judge Braidwood, who led the exhaustive inquiry following the 2007 death of Polish immigrant Robert Zakanski, spent 2 years and oversaw 2 inquiries, one on the overall safety concerns around the taser and one on Mr. Zakanski's brutal death after being tasered 5 times by the RCMP at the Vancouver International Airport. He spoke to experts in emergency medicine, cardiology, electrophysiology, pathology, epidemiology, psychology, and psychiatry. Judge Lamoureux did not refer in her 7-page ruling to Mr. Braidwood's 1,000-plus page reports. Mr. Braidwood concluded that excited delirium is not a medical condition. Mr. Bowe was on cocaine and acting wildly in a dark house. The tasering and heavy-handed restraint by Calgary police may or may not have been justified, though the judge should have questioned kicks to the side of Mr. Bowe's body. Any policy built around excited delirium would be an irrational response to such a death. Judges and policymakers should read Mr. Braidwood's reports. And that, an editorial in the Globe and Mail. Watchdog accuses officers of excessive force at G20. Police union bids to quash charges against 5 men on the grounds that the investigation took too long. 6 months after one provincial police watchdog decided there wasn't enough evidence to lay criminal charges against several officers accused of beating G20 protester Adam Nobody, a different agency has ordered that 5 policemen face disciplinary hearings in the incident. Constable Adams, Andalib Gurtani, Donaldson, and Simpson were part of a mobile squad policing the protests that day. When they decided to arrest him, Mr. Nobody fled. Video evidence detailed by the report says that Constables Farrell and Adams punched Mr. Nobody and, along with Constable Simpson, also kneed him. Constable Andalib Gortani, who arrived after the others, was seen on video winding up his baton. Mr. Nobody suffered a broken nose and cheekbone. The report cleared Constable Lowe. It also found no evidence to support charges against plainclothes officers Todd Story and Luke Watson, whom Mr. Nobody alleges beat him further behind a van while hurling verbal abuse and challenging him to a fight. The Office of the Independent Police Review Director owes much of his success in identifying the policeman at the scene to Acting Detective Sergeant Chris Kirkpatrick, an investigator with the force's Professional Standards Branch. In some cases, he picked out minor details to figure out who was who. All five accused are frontline patrol officers. Constable Fardell is assigned to East York. The others are based out of suburban 31 Division. Constable Adams was involved in another controversial incident, the arrest of 18-year-old Junior Manon, 7 weeks before the G20. Mr. Manon died of asphyxiation after a struggle with police. A spokeswoman for the SIU said the agency received the OIPRD report Friday from reporters and was still considering whether to reopen its own criminal investigation based on the findings. And that by Adrian Morrow and Tu Tan Ha in the Toronto section of the Globe and Mail. Poverty rising in G20, says Oxfam. A report released by the international charity Oxfam shows why anger about income inequality sparked protests that have swept the world from Terrier Square to Wall Street, says Oxfam Canada's executive director Robert Fox. More than half of the world's poorest people live in G20 countries, making them a key battleground in the fight against global poverty. But within many wealthier countries, including Canada, the battle appears to be a losing one. Income inequality is growing in almost all G20 members, while it is falling in most low and lower middle income countries, says the report titled Left Behind by the G20. Canada comes fifth on the list of countries with the fastest growing gaps. However, little of Canada's inequality growth has happened since 2000. This country has a history of greater social protection and support through unemployment insurance and other programs, says Oxfam Canada's executive director, Robert Fox. But that support is being reduced at the same time as market forces are cresting. The level of social assistance and support for the poorest are not increasing at the rate of inflation. Meanwhile, there's a documented increase in compensation for senior executives, and the wealthy are becoming wealthier at an increasing pace as the poor are falling behind. Korea is the only high-income country to reduce inequality during the past two decades. The report also warns that environmental degradation targets poor people even in relatively rich countries. Economic activity is depleting the Earth's natural assets, including the capacity of the atmosphere to absorb carbon dioxide, with the costs borne disproportionately by poor women and men. The report urges countries to tackle the inequalities that exclude girls and women from participating in economic growth and to introduce land reform programs that give the rural poor a foot up the economic ladder. Fixing the inequality gap and environmental degradation depends on strong policy decisions, the report says. They include redistributing wealth through social programs, investing in universal access to education and health care, and promoting reforms for progressive taxation. That by Olivia Ward, foreign affairs reporter for the Toronto Star. Wealth shared unfairly, study says. Ottawa is suppressing key parts of a politically explosive federal report that reveals Ontario is being shortchanged by Canada's national wealth-sharing scheme, the Star has learned. The 67-page study is a searing assault on a $15.4 billion a year equalization system that redistributes taxpayers' dollars to ensure equivalent levels of health, education, and other programs across the country. Its conclusion? Ontario and BC lose out because it's much costlier to operate in those provinces. Conversely, Quebec and the Maritimes, where the cost of living is lower, reap disproportionate benefits. When the government was forced to release the report, it removed large, potentially controversial chunks. The report, an operational expenditure need equalization formula for Canada, was written in 2006 by Peter Goosen, then director of federal-provincial relations at the Federal Finance Department, to analyze how much it costs to deliver services in various provinces. The Star obtained the uncensored report. Ottawa has never taken into account that wages and cost of living expenses are higher when dispensing equalization payouts. The main conclusion of the study is clear. If you were to include any sense of the cost of providing public services in the equalization formula, Ontario would be getting a lot more in fiscal transfers, said Matthew Mendelson, director of the Mowat Centre for Policy Innovation at the University of Toronto. Ontario would certainly make a case that when you just give us our share to hire nurses, we can't hire as many nurses as you can in Manitoba or New Brunswick, but none of that's calculated. This study really means that the entire system of regional subsidies is nonsense, said David McKinnon, a former senior servant who has written two studies on equalization for the Ontario Chamber of Commerce. It shows that everything the federal government has been saying to the public for the 50 years or so they've been doing equalization is misleading. McKinnon said he doubted partisan politics played any part in censoring a report commissioned by a Liberal government and then locked down by Prime Minister Stephen Harper's Conservatives. Governments of all political stripes would do the redaction. It's deer in the headlights. The federal government has never looked at expenditure need. Even more seriously, it's never examined economic impact of equalization. That by Robert Benzie, the Queen's Park Bureau Chief at the Toronto Star. Many Canadians can't afford to take drugs as directed. One in four Canadians who do not have drug insurance are unable to afford to take their prescription drugs as directed, a new study shows. And overall, one in 10 Canadians, even if they do have public or private insurance, struggle to pay for their drug treatments, according to research published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal. These levels of non-adherence are something to be concerned about, Michael Law, an assistant professor at the Centre for Health Services and Policy Research at the University of British Columbia, said in an interview. Dr. Law said there are several reasons patients fail to take medications as they're directed to do by health professionals. They don't like the side effects. They're forgetful. They feel they're no longer necessary, and so on. But he said lack of affordability is one of the chief reasons, and it's important to understand the extent of the problem because it's amenable to policy action. In this case, Dr. Law said the obvious solution is to ensure that everyone can afford necessary prescription drugs. The study shows those who have the most difficulty paying for their drugs are patients with chronic conditions that entail recurring drug costs. Low-income citizens also struggle, even if they are insured. Lack of universal drug coverage is a glaring hole in Medicare, Dr. Law said. Danielle Martin, a family doctor at Women's College Hospital in Toronto, said she routinely sees patients who cannot afford their drug treatments, and they tend to be the working poor. It's the taxi drivers, nannies, and restaurant employees who often fall through the cracks, she said. Dr. Martin, who is also president of the group Canadian Doctors for Medicare, is a staunch advocate for pharmacare or adding prescription drugs to the services paid for by Medicare. A small cost outlay can sometimes prevent higher costs in the future, she said. Dr. Martin said the fear that universal public drug insurance is unaffordable is unfounded. A national pharmacare program would save money and improve economic efficiency, she said. And that by Andre Picard, award-winning public health reporter in The Globe and Mail. Retirement homes face strict rules. Legislation dealing strictly with retirement homes was introduced in 2010. Draft regulations meant to give the bill teeth will be posted at www.ontarioseniors.ca. Under the Act, the new Retirement Homes Regulatory Authority will be in charge of investigating complaints, and it will have the power to license homes, issue monetary penalties, and if need be, revoke licenses. Recently, Star reporters Moira Welsh and Dale Brazeo exposed a litany of abuses inside one West End Toronto retirement home. Brazeo went undercover and witnessed seniors left for hours in urine-soaked and feces-filled diapers. There was no toilet paper, leaving many residents to wipe themselves with their hands or use a flimsy communal towel to wash up. The food was bland and had only traces of protein. France Gélinas, the new Democrat MPP for Nickelbelt, has worked for years on trying to shape the bill. She brought forward 92 amendments, but 91 were rejected. Here we have this captive audience of vulnerable seniors. They need our protection, Jelena said. We passed this bill that I voted against and still would vote against that set up a self-regulatory body of for-profit agencies. Natalie Mera of the Ontario Health Coalition agreed the act is fundamentally flawed because the regulatory body is dominated by the industry and should be rewritten. We have no faith in the process, she said. And that by Tanya Talaga of the Queen's Park Bureau at the Toronto Star. Elder abuse hotline dangles by fraying thread. With 27 days left to come up with $75,000, the Ontario Network for the Prevention of Elder Abuse is staring at the prospect of closing its senior safety line. It handles 13,000 calls a year from frightened seniors, distraught family members, worried friends, and concerned caregivers. It operates round the clock in 150 languages. Each operator is trained to understand the needs of vulnerable seniors and offer practical, confidential advice. It's now running at 100% capacity, but no one is willing to pay for it. The Seniors Protection Network, like many other voluntary groups, assumed that once it proved the hotline was viable and needed, the provincial government would take over. 3 years ago, that was reasonable, said Terry Kay, executive director of the Ontario Network for the Prevention of Elder Abuse, which created the helpline. In the current fiscal situation, it's very hard to establish new programs. She's still scrambling to secure long-term funding. Several potential partners have expressed interest, but even if one of them steps in, the money won't come through until at least mid-year. And that's why the network is appealing to the public for help. This vital hotline simply cannot be shut down. The immediate need is $75,000, which will sustain it for another 6 months. So far, the organization has raised just $5,000. The majority of Ontarians don't want to acknowledge or hear about elder abuse. The association tried lobbying MPPs, but as the province's budgetary woes deepened, they resorted to expressions of moral support. It tried to get media attention. According to people who work in the field, between 4% and 10% of seniors are physically, emotionally, sexually, or financially abused or deprived of life's necessities, but these are just estimates. Seniors may be reluctant to identify perpetrators, especially when it is a member of the family, but those who are in serious danger can sometimes be persuaded to talk to a police officer. The federal government committed $567,000 last fall to developing tools to detect and measure elder abuse. A handful of backbenchers have introduced private members' bills to expose and prevent the victimization of older people. These initiatives are useful, Kay says, but it's essential to preserve existing services. We'd go from month to month if we had to, she said, emphasizing that any donation, no matter how small, would be welcome. She shouldn't have to beg. Abused seniors shouldn't have to depend on the mercy of strangers. More information is available at www.onpea.org. Again, that's www.onpea.org. And that from Carol Gore in the Friday, January 27th Toronto Star. Concern for the disabled. In a controversial editorial on sex selection in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, interim editor-in-chief Rajendra Kale identified female feticide as an evil that devalues women. In his view, the deliberate use of ultrasonography to identify female fetuses, followed by their abortion in some ethnic groups, is about discrimination against women in its most extreme form. But why stop at gender? What about disability? Consider a different characteristic. If Dr. Kale had cited evidence that a significant number of Canadians were deliberately using ultrasonography to identify fetuses with cleft palates or lips, missing limbs, spina bifida, or Down syndrome, followed by their abortion, would he regard this as discrimination against some people with disabilities in its most extreme form? I suspect not. Indeed, an ultrasound is part of prenatal screening that the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists believes should be offered to all pregnant women as part of surveillance for fetal anomalies. As any woman who has ever had an undesirable outcome after a prenatal screening ultrasound knows, abortion is an option discussed. For those of us living with, or living with someone with, Down syndrome, a cleft lip, or a missing limb, The selection against fetuses with these characteristics is as troubling as selection against female fetuses. Indeed, the act of surveillance for and selection against fetuses with these characteristics sends the message that people with these characteristics are less valuable to society, just as the selection of female fetuses sends the message that women are less valuable than men. Moreover, why should we be more concerned about discrimination against women than discrimination against people with disabilities? As both a woman and a mother of a child with an ultrasound-detectable anomaly, I believe that Dr. Kale's arguments about discrimination could be extended to fetal characteristics other than the presence of male and female genitalia. In a society committed to protecting the equality rights of women and persons with disabilities, we should be just as concerned about the use of ultrasound to identify and eliminate fetuses on the basis of disability as we are about sex. And that by Roxanne Mikidiuk, Associate Professor of Law at Osgoode Hall Law School, in the Globe and Mail. And that's all the news we have for Disrespect this week, but come back next week, we may have more. Etta James leaves us on an upbeat note with Good Rockin' Daddy. This is Jeff Langhorne of Disrespect Radio. I think you're here instead of listening to commercial radio because you want to. Well, something funny, I'm here because I want to too. All our hosts on community radio are unpaid volunteers. Our management takes less than scale, so they must want to too. Our guests, they have to want to as well. They're not looking for the big endorsement. They're not looking for big bucks. They're here because they want to talk to you, the CFMU listener. We're simulcast around the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And we're also podcast back 6 or 7 years at this time. We're archived at radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can reach the show at disrespect@lycos.com. Come back at showtime next week on CFMU 93.3 on your radio at 12 noon on Thursdays. You know you want to.